Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, Christy, we're talking with Dr. Laura Stark, Assistant Professor at Vanderbilt University's Center for Medicine, Health, and Safety, and Associate Editor of the journal History and Health, about the ethical DNA of scientific research. I'm very excited about this conversation.
I'm looking forward to it, too. It's a time, an important time to talk about this, given new regulation, new changes in the way that we investigate the ethics of scientific research. So we're going to have a great conversation. But first, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about milk from the Tasmanian devil.
And I can at least figure out what they are.
Fighting superbugs.
And we're going to talk about tweets and health, which we'll be telling about a little about our own tweeting, perhaps.
We'll talk about sexual health and erectile dysfunction, potentially improving with exercise.
And we're going to talk about hearing loss. Let's dive right in and talk about Tasmanian devils. I must say, I've never seen a Tasmanian devil, except perhaps in a movie or on TV.
I have in the cartoons, but that's it for me as well. But these are small marsupials that are in Australia and other places. This was Australian researchers. So they took these Australian marsupials and studied them and realized, or they started to realize, that their offsprings didn't have some of the same infections that happened to be very hard to treat infections in humans. Infections like MRSA, or the kind of Staph aureus, a kind of bacteria that's resistant to many antibiotics, and other things like vancomycin-resistant enterococcus, which is something that can get inside your gut and cause very dangerous diarrhea.
Yeah, these marsupials, these Tasmanian devils, have these kind of proteins, these peptides that appear to be able to kill those infections. And the scientists are trying to kind of make treatments that mimic these peptides. And they were looking at these devil's genetic code. I love that. The devil's genetic code. And to look at way to recreate these peptides, these infection-fighting compounds that they call catholicidins. I'm not even sure if I said that word right, but it's a tough word to say and spell. But basically, they published this work in Scientific Reports, and they found six different peptides.
And the exciting part about this is that, you know, the peptides are the same peptides that appear to be able to kill these hard-to-treat infections. And this offers a lot of promise to us as we urgently need to develop new drugs that will fight treatment-resistant infections. And so this offers a lot of promise that there's something about these peptides that are already made in the animal world that perhaps were developed by these marsupials over time as part of a way to protect themselves, protect their offspring from these dangerous infections.
Did you know, Christy, a little trivia here, that not only are we talking about the Tasmanian devils, the Tamar wallabies have 8 of these peptides and possums have 12.
Wow.
I mean, that makes you think about possums in a very different light, doesn't
it? It sure does. It does make you like possums a little bit more because they may have some answers that will help us fight dangerous infections. So certainly more study is needed, but it's exciting when you find these discoveries right in nature.
Our next research,
are you tweeting about it?
Is research that really starts to look at, because so many tweets, I think researchers in this particular study looked at 1% of tweets between April 2015 and 2016, and there were 80 million tweets from 600,000 users in the United States in that short period of time alone.
And so using these geotagged tweets, they could look at what neighborhoods the people were coming from and what kinds of things people were tweeting about. And these are researchers at the University of Utah and Washington, two very strong schools, strong in public health, strong in primary care.
Strong and in tweeting.
They must be strong in investigating treating. But they were able to build a map of the U.S. by neighborhood with these indicators of how happy and how active people in that neighborhood are and what their diets are like, and then what kinds of things they're tweeting about.
And I did see that 20% of the tweets were classified as happy, and I guess that's good. I imagine that there are other classifications. And I'm frankly right now not certain fully what one does with this other than recognize when there are enough trends happening that may be geocoding. I've seen this with, for instance, search terms with Google search for flu. And one can see flu outbreaks occurring even before things are occurring. And I think tweets, you can see certainly public health emergencies happening quickly before the mainstream media can report them.
I completely agree. There's a lot of promise here to being able to discover things through tweets, but this itself doesn't yet tell us what that thing is. Okay, well, let's talk about something less happy, and this is about erectile dysfunction. But the happy part is that physical activity and exercise can improve erectile dysfunction.
Yeah, I was really pleased to see research that takes us beyond just simply saying, you know, take a medication, though the medications can be helpful for men who have erectile dysfunction, but to then look at what is the effect of physical activity, and can physical activity and different physical activities help, and what subset of men may the physical activity be helpful in?
So in this study, they combined multiple randomized control trials and pooled the data. They found 7 studies published between 2004 and 2013 that had a total of 505 men who were tracked at least 8 weeks up to 2 years. And altogether, these 292 men who were randomly assigned to get exercise or do pelvic floor muscle exercise or a combination, and then the other half were told not to exercise. And what they found as they measured the International Index of Erectile Function, which is a standardized tool, they found that the people who exercised increased their scores and had higher function than the men who were assigned not to exercise.
And the particular exercises that seemed to help were those among men who had higher heart attack risk, who had had a prostate removal. It wasn't just pelvic floor exercises. It was actually, you know, activities that really increased their overall exercise fitness. And so fitness really does help. I think it's a groundbreaking research. There's very little downside. We should promote it.
We should. Okay, let's talk about one more thing. You having any trouble hearing, Adam?
Unfortunately, I am a little bit. And we've talked in the past about the need for, as people get older and hearing loss, to really continue to promote access to improved hearing techniques.
And in the study, they looked at the parts of the brains of typical older adults and found that it's a part of the brain that causes them to struggle amidst background noise, even when the hearing would be considered normal in a clinical assessment, that there's something about the normal way that brains age, that as people get older, it's just harder to distinguish the background noise from the regular sound of speech. And so that may be part of the reason, published in the Journal of Neurophysiology, why we have to say things a little more clearly and a little more slowly sometimes, even for normal adults.
And older people will need more time to figure out what someone is saying. So one has to, I think, when one's communicating, perhaps do it in a quiet room, look someone in the face, really say it some more slowly and not rush a conversation, which is probably good for all of us.
That's probably true. Okay, that concludes the Research That Matters portion of our show. We've been able to talk about hearing and about exercise,
about tweets, and about erectile dysfunction.
All right, well, we're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll be talking with Dr. Laura Stark, assistant professor at Vanderbilt University, about the ethical DNA of scientific research. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
UNC Family Medicine's #2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Adam and I will be talking with Dr. Laura Stark, assistant professor at Vanderbilt University's Center for Medicine, Health, and Society, and associate editor of the journal History and Theory, and we're talking about the ethical DNA of scientific research.
Welcome, Dr. Stark.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
You know, we are thrilled to talk about something that really goes across the very fabric of the DNA of scientific research across the United States internationally, and to have you with us. Maybe it would help for our listeners to know a little bit about you and your background. Did you wake up one day and decide you're going to be a historian and medical ethicist? How did you come into this field?
I was born that way, I tell you. No, I did my graduate work at Princeton, and at the time I was not only a social science researcher, but I was also interested in particular in the history of ideas about what's appropriate and inappropriate to do to people in medical research. So having to actually go through institutional review boards, which are the shorthand for this is IRBs. These are the groups at every university, most research institutions that have to review research before people can carry it out. I had to manage that myself as a researcher and also had these interests in the intersection between ethics and medicine. And so I decided to really pursue and look into how these groups went about making decisions and why they came to exist in the first place.
Well, before we jump into the history, I wonder if you might also frame for our listeners, it's tied into the history for sure, but why the ethical guidelines are important for patients, for people.
The guidelines are important, and I think most people would see them in their everyday lives in the form of consent forms. In doctor's clinics, anyone who has seen a poster or a flyer out somewhere saying, research participants needed. So these sorts of documents we see around consent forms and flyers are just the tip of an iceberg of a whole regulatory system. And right now, the federal government and organizations around the United States and even abroad are in the process of changing these. And these haven't been substantially changed since they were originally created in the 1970s. So this at this very moment is a really important moment for thinking about how research is regulated and the way in which people will be thinking about and experiencing consent in their own lives and thinking about whether they may or may not want to be involved in research themselves, either as research participants or as members of the staff who carry out research.
We're talking with Dr. Laura Stark, who recently just also wrote a really important editorial, a perspective article in the New England Journal of Medicine about this topic of the ethical DNA and what's happening in the change. And I guess one of the things that struck me about the article, Dr. Stark, is that the basis for the founding of institutional review boards was not necessarily, at least from what I read in your work, about patient and patient understanding, maybe the consent forms, but a legal basis. Can you speak to that? Because that was kind of surprising, a little upsetting, actually.
Sure thing. I want to also mention my co-author on that piece, Dr. Ernie Green at Johns Hopkins. And so it was great to have a team working on that piece together. What we were interested in is how in 1974, these original rules passed. They're called the National Research, not especially descriptive, but anyhow, good now. And typically, the story that told about them, and this is no doubt the case, is that there were research scandals, including the very terrible Tuskegee syphilis experiments, were revealed at this moment in the early 1970s, and therefore we needed laws. But the question is, and this is the point that I really want to push on here, is why we got this method of reviewing research in particular, not just any rules that would, for example, allow researchers to regulate themselves, for example, through an ethics code or a professional organization. What we have in the present day that was put in place in the 1970s was something very different, and that's a committee review system. And what this means is that any research institution, any university where research on people is done, there's groups of people from different fields who have to come together. They cannot be involved in the research and to decide whether it's ethically acceptable or not. What this means is that the researchers lose a lot of the decision-making power at this point, and the groups can shift what researchers have to do and don't do. And the reason this was done, the moment it was done, was because all of these terrible scandals were revealed. But the reason that it was done is that the federal government was a major funder of research in medicine, of course, and also in the social sciences. And as a funder, they were concerned that they were the ones who were going to get sued. So what the rules did was require anyone who got government money for research or even to fund an institution to set up one of these boards in their own institution, and that institution would then draw the legal liability. So it was an effort by the federal government to move liability to the institutions they were funding so they wouldn't get sued themselves.
Well, it does make sense to separate it, perhaps, if they're the ones funding things and also the ones regulating it. But yet many, or if not most, based on your writing, most international countries do have some sort of central, either federal or central agency regulating this. Is that correct?
Yes. Most are much more centralized in the U.S. So currently in the United States, there's upwards of 4,000 institutional review boards, and it really makes good sense to have the people who know the area, know the context, making the decisions rather than having people's research be reviewed by people far away. But one of the consequences of this is that it's made collaboration very difficult. And this is a part of the reason why the rules have really needed to change in the present day. There's so much more collaborative research. And so when you have institutions and universities with separate committees all reviewing the same protocols, the same proposals for research, what ends up happening is that these contexts are all slightly different. So they make different changes to what the researchers would like to do. And it makes collaboration very, very difficult because you have differences across institutions about what they would be willing to say is right or wrong for any one given research project.
You know, we're going to take a break in a minute or two and come back and dive into the changes that are being proposed. But I want to just ask you one question. You mentioned the consent forms, and I was involved in research when I was a fellow looking at consent form readability across all IRBs at our institutions, so social sciences, medicine, dentistry, public health. And I was just shocked, and this isn't that long ago, that the readability was well over a college level. And the process and the descriptions have gotten more, not less complex. So it seems like at a basic level, have we made improvements in basic things of saying the primary people we're trying to protect are our patients and they need to understand what it is we're asking?
The super point. One of the big changes that's going to happen is that the consent forms now must be considerably shorter and they have to hit basic points. They have to be basically put a word limit on consent forms. And one of the concerns was not only that the consent forms as they were, as they had emerged, were a lot of legal language for the reasons that I explained, very low readability. And the consequence was that they actually didn't protect people that well. In addition to that, they also had a chilling effect on research. So all of these problems consolidated, and the sort of the big punchline for people who will be seeing consent forms now, after the new rules are passed, is that they'll be much shorter because they've really taken off in a new direction from the legal concern.
Well, that's good news. So it'll be shorter, and hopefully they'll pay attention to the complexity of the words and concepts so that patients can understand it.
Absolutely.
I hope so. Okay, well, we are going to need to take a short break. And when we come back, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Laura Stark, assistant professor at Vanderbilt University Center for Medicine, Health, and Society, and associate editor of the journal History and Theory. And we're talking about the ethical DNA of scientific research. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Laura Stark, assistant professor at Vanderbilt University Center for Medicine, Health, and Society, and associate editor of the journal History and Theory, about the ethical DNA of scientific research. And for our listeners, we've been going under the assumption that you know, and surely you do, that medical research and new discovery is critical to our future and important for us to promote new discovery in medicine and in the human body. And it's also important that we protect patients and humans with respect to your rights and participating in those studies fully and doing it in an ethical way. Complicated stuff, but thankfully, Dr. Stark's been involved and has been sharing with us some new developments after 40 years in the process that we go by in our nation to review this research ethically and make sure we're protecting people in the process. Dr. Stark, catch us up to speed on the biggest changes that will allow more flexibility and promote research and promote ethics and research in the new IRB recommendations.
There's two big areas. The first, in addition to the everyday experience of people who participate in research themselves through signing consent forms, the two other big areas are simply what is actually regulated under the law for research, and then the second big area is how this is regulated. So in about the types of things that previously were very heavily restricted were research that was pretty low risk. And so this gets to issues about how ideas about what is risky, what is right and wrong, can really change over time. So in the 1970s, for example, asking people questions about their sex lives seemed so exceptionally risky that it required other people to be watching over researchers. But in the present day, the protections are such, and the oversight is such, that, and also the everyday sensibilities, that sorts of questions that would seem a little bit disconcerting simply don't have the same resonance of being very, very risky. And in the present day, the concerns tend to be much more about physical interventions rather than talking. So things that were better in the present day seem as not especially risky, although they are, there are risks involved. These now are going to be reviewed more by the researcher by an online decision tool. So researchers will actually be able to decide for themselves whether they need to be reviewed. And this is a hugely empowering thing for researchers who want to, for example, find out how patients are feeling about their experiences and things like that. That one of the other big changes and will be related is that clinical trials that weren't actually funded by the U.S. government in any part actually got this huge free pass previously because the U.S. government had just been concerned about liabilities on their own end and weren't, they didn't also have very much power to regulate anyone else. And so the new rules will actually also be regulating the whole area of clinical trials that had been, the public had been entrusting the clinical trials industry to self-regulate. So that's a big area of change.
Well, I want to just ask you about two questions that just come to mind about these areas that you just mentioned, which has to do with, one, patient empowerment. Are patients, have patients been involved from the beginning, and are they really supportive? Because I could also see that there may be some concern that there's a lessening of overview and concerns about safety. And then the kind of corollary would be confidentiality. How do these new regulations both empower patients continue but also protect confidentiality?
One of the reasons why thinking about these regulations for patients right now is so important is because they will really shape who has things like tissue samples, like blood samples, and can be using the material. One of the big areas to emerge since the 1970s that previously just wasn't even included in regulation because nobody had ever thought about it was simply what to do with tissue samples. If you might want to use it in the future, for example, for DNA research. And currently, the regulations are being revised so that it'll be very, very easy for researchers to use tissue samples and blood in the future for more research. This is one of the big hot areas of debate, but I think that the people who just go to the clinic and have their blood drawn or have had a DNA, any tissue sample taken, should really think long and hard about, because the default in these potentially revised rules is that it'll be very easy for the assumption to be that a person just donates. That will be the default. But on the flip side, you could also turn the default around so that researchers always have to ask in very clear language, very explicitly, for people to donate tissue samples for future research, just so people can think about the uses they want their biological samples put, not only issues of privacy and confidentiality, which are, of course, important, but some people might not want their genetic material used for particular kinds of research.
Sure, sure. Now, you also talked earlier about collaboration and about some of the challenges related to the way that IRBs are done in local institutions and some challenges around collaboration. And we know that research is increasingly a team sport. You need multiple different kinds of doctors, different disciplines, different related fields involved to advance new discovery. And there's a lot of value in working across different institutions across the nation and internationally to see if something really is true as we're trying to research our various topics. Help us understand how these new guidelines will either promote or enhance collaboration, or if there's a possibility that it can make it even harder.
The big way that the proposed new rules would change the way in which collaborative research is regulated is through what's called a single IRB. So it's a sort of a cumbersome phrase, but an institutional review board, that's a research review committee at a given university. And collaborators who are at different universities, really importantly, are in different countries, for example, have to appoint a single IRB that would really be in charge of coordinating one review for all of the researchers, because they're all basically carrying out the same project. Because, for example, there may be either a comparative element to it, or you need a study population that you can't simply get in one area. So having a single review board, it seems basic, but this is the level that they're really operating at, because research practices have changed so greatly since the 1970s. And the funny thing about the law is the law doesn't change.
You know, Dr. Stark, you published a book a couple of years ago, and I'd like you if you could just maybe say a couple words about the book called Behind Closed Doors, IRBs and the Making of Ethical Research. What was the main finding or two that you got in your book, and how can our listeners get a copy if they're interested?
It was published in 2012 by University of Chicago Press, and my big question was about how these ethics review committees actually go about making decisions. One of the big things that I was able to do was study for 1 year these review boards. There were actually three of them that gave me permission to sit in on their meetings and audio record many of their meetings as well. Able to analyze how they went about arriving at a decision. And what it showed was the disparities, the differences in whose opinions really mattered. So, for example, typically there's a lot of weight given to the value of community representatives on review boards. And yet, these community representatives actually can't get much traction in the discussion, even if they have really valuable things to contribute. The book was the first time that there was a long-term, what's called ethnography, of one of these ethics review boards to see what they actually do when they go behind closed doors. And the second big issue that I was interested in is why we didn't just get any old regulations, but why we got these particular regulations in the 1970s. And that, again, as I had mentioned previously, has to do with the federal government's desire to shift liability to institutions that they were giving their money to, rather than draw the lawsuits themselves. And as unsavory as that sounds, only all of the scandals were a big motivator why that moment, but it was a legal issue at heart.
Well, we are grateful for the work you're doing. We'll put a link to your book on our blog and make that available for our listeners. But I think if you Google Behind Closed Doors, what is the full title?
Behind Closed Doors, IRBs and the Making of Ethical Research.
Okay, with Dr. Laura Stark. Thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
We've been talking with Dr. Laura Stark, assistant professor at Vanderbilt University, about the ethical DNA of scientific research. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the house call segment of our show today, we've got some really interesting house calls from listeners' questions and concerns. You can send your own question or concern to yourhealth@unc.edu, and we'll look forward to addressing those on the show. We'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first house call question about floaters. And we're not talking about those barges that are where people go out drinking, are we?
No. This listener asks, I get the sense that there are more floaters in my eye now than there used to be. They don't obstruct my vision in any way, but they can be pretty annoying. Can I do anything for them?
Well, these type of floaters are one of those things that people like are experienced, but they're not really certain what they're experiencing. And it's because these are like small spots that can kind of drift through your field of vision. Like if you're looking at something bright, they could stand out. You know, you're looking at a white paper on a blue sky. And they don't really affect your sight, but they're pretty darn annoying. And sometimes people think of them as black squiggly lines. Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds like, you know, you see these things sometimes and you think, was that just real? You close your eyes, and, you know, you kind of flick your eyes and then kind of go away. And they seem to get better, so you don't think too much about them. And they seem to be related to this gel-like substance in the back of your eye and the vitreous and the change in that, particularly as we age, and more frequently in people who are ages 50 to 75. I don't know if you've ever had a relative you've heard them talking about, yeah, I got these floaters that come and go. You ever hear that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I've actually had not very many, but a few myself, and they can be kind of annoying. I sometimes think they're like a bug in the corner of my eyes. I find myself batting it away.
Yeah, you know, they can be annoying, and you can try to get them out of your field of vision, and that seems to work. You can kind of move your eyes. You kind of shake your head back and forth or move it around. Occasionally, you may need to go see the eye doctor. Certainly, if you start to see a whole lot more and you didn't have them there, if you see these flashes of light that are coming and going, if it's starting to come on quickly and get worse, these are all signs that something else could be going on. You don't want to get a detached retina, cataracts, other things that are a little more serious. So good question. Our next house call question is about someone who is pregnant and has a question.
I am 8 months pregnant with my first child, and I plan on breastfeeding. My sister had horrible mastitis with both of her children. Is this something I should be concerned about?
Well, I think that mastitis is a really good question. Mastitis, meaning the mastos, the breast from the Greek, and the itis, the inflammation, so inflammation of the breast, is usually an infection of the breast. Now, as to whether this problem has any relationship to genetics, there seems to be some genetic variability, certainly in non-human models. But I think more importantly is in humans, it's less likely to be genetic and more likely to be a problem that occurs in breastfeeding in the setting of poor drainage or prolonged engorgement. If you've had one episode of mastitis, you're at risk for more. If you've had it in one pregnancy, you're at risk in the next pregnancy. But for our particular listener here, you know, they haven't had this before. Redness, pain, fever, muscle aches. This is a bacterial infection, and it can get into the bloodstream. You can get a kind of a hot, firm breast. You can have a fever. You may want to culture the breast milk to help guide selection of antibiotics. Usually it's a superficial infection, that staph, that skin bacteria that can get infected in there. And you want to do anything that can reduce the pain and swelling, help encourage getting the breast milk out, ongoing breastfeeding, pumping, hand expression, and antibiotics. So in this particular case, I think we can reassure more than anything else rather than kind of scare.
Is there anything that if she is worried about it, she can do to prevent it or to help prevent? Or is it more just you have to treat it once it arises?
I think making sure she didn't have a superficial skin infection, if she's got like really dry breasts and eczema or the cracks in the, well, that would be a portal of entry of the breast. Mm-hmm. Talking with a lactation consultant early, and frequent breastfeeding, which is really what you want to do for the health of the child.
Great.
What's our very next house call?
I'll often get shin splints, especially when I run daily. What causes them and how can I treat them?
Having been a runner in a former life myself, if you were like me, you kind of ran, you know, 2-3 miles a couple times a week, and then all of a sudden something got in your head that, oh, I could do 6 or 8 miles, and you went out and just like tried to run a whole bunch, or you started really increasing how much you're running, like I want to really train harder, and you start running really hard, and after 2 or 3 days, boy, you get this pain in your leg, and these are the shin splints, which are also called the medial tibial stress syndrome. How do you like that name?
It's very fancy.
How about we just call it shin splints?
I'd go with shin splints.
And this is really, it's classified as pain that's along the shin bone, the inner edge of the lower leg, and it's repeated trauma to the muscles and the tissues that surround that bone. And really, it's a disease of prolonged running, jumping. And typically, it comes on when you increase your activity or you're really going beyond what the tissues can do. And that's the kind of pain. And what do you think the treatment is?
I'd say something to do with resting them and or stretching them.
Yeah, you're exactly correct. Really is initially really resting them and letting it heal up. You can do some ice after running, doing strengthening and gradual return to activity, because these high levels of stress create inflammation in the muscles, and then that, of course, causes the pain. And you got to get rid of the pain and swelling before you return to activity. People return too soon and do too much. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, most people can do really well over normal several weeks. I don't know if you've ever used orthotics or shoe inserts. A lot of people have. That sometimes actually can be helpful for some people. A specialist, foot specialist, physical therapist may be needed, maybe x-rays, but most people, it's a clinical diagnosis. What's our very last house call?
I get headaches every few weeks. I can't seem to figure out a trigger or a pattern, and they generally only last a few hours, so they aren't very disruptive. Is there anything I should keep in mind?
Well, first off, only last a few hours? Oh my goodness. That sounds kind of disruptive.
I guess that's true. Yeah, a few hours is a few hours.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, from a doctor's perspective, oh, it only lasts a few hours. If a doctor ever says that to you, just like, you know, slap them. We might think, oh, unless it's lasting a few days. But if it's said it lasts a couple minutes, even a couple minutes, if they were really severe, which sometimes people do, there's a headache called ice pick headache. You ever heard of that one?
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like someone sticking a little ice pick in.
Sounds awful.
Oh, it is. And it's like most people describe this as just really, really bad pain that might last for a few seconds to minutes, but it's like someone sticking a pick in their head. Ooh. Like, ugh. So headache syndromes and really understanding what's going on here. The real question is, are these migraines or are they muscle tension or are they mixed? Now, like many people, I get headaches at times. Do you ever get headaches?
Oh, yeah, all the time, especially when I try to switch between glasses and contacts too frequently. That really bugs my head.
Well, and I sometimes when I wear my glasses for too long and that strain, I can certainly understand that. For me, it's when I'm not sleeping well.
Yeah.
I'm not eating well. I'm drinking my 5 cups of coffee a day. I'm not drinking any
water.
And then I have a beer. You know, it seems like that's kind of like, I don't.
There's a pattern.
There's a pattern there. Yeah. Now, so for many people, you have to ask, what's the pattern? You know, what's going on here? And then really focus in on, is there stress? People say, I say, is there any stress? They say, no. And I say, well, tell me about your life. Well, I'm not sleeping. I'm not eating. There's stress in my family. I'm caring for my mother-in-law at home. You know, and they go on and on. It's like, whoa.
Guess
and
what?
You don't think there's stress, right?
That's stress. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think, you know, I think you have to really put all these things in mind, really a detailed headache history. This is one of those things. I think once before I've heard you come in, like to come in with lists when you come and see your doctor, Laura.
Yes, definitely. Yeah.
I like to you to bring in a detailed headache history.
Well, good to know.
Type it up for me. Put it in preferably one page single space. and let's talk about what you're doing. And also, are you taking lots of pain medications? If you're taking Tylenol every day, aspirin every day, Advil every day, that may be the problem. And the treatment may be actually stopping doing that.
Interesting. Yeah.
Well, that's our health sciences librarians to put up a kind of a maybe a medical diary history of they might recommend for a headache history that you could take to your doctor.
Yeah.
Well, that'll conclude the house calls today, and we'd like to thank all of you for joining us for your health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns that are important to your health. You can send us your own questions at yourhealth@unc.edu. That's, again, yourhealth@unc.edu. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org. Download us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. And we'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Laura Stark. We hope to join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, we'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
presented by UNC Family Medicine.